this urge that you're experiencing, it'll probably last for 10 or 15 minutes. And with urges, we describe them a bit like a wave, because that intensity of feeling will grow and it'll get bigger and it'll get stronger. But you have to remember that it will also fall, a bit like a wave. And so what we encourage people to do is to imagine it's a wave, that feeling, but also imagine that you're a surfer and you're going to surf the urge. And so this discomfort is temporary. If you can just hold on and surf that urge, and it will pass. The other analogy that we sometimes use as well as the wave analogy, is imagining it's like a cloud in the sky. So any of our emotions or feelings, whether they're kind of unpleasant ones or urges, they're temporary, a bit like the clouds in the sky are temporary, and they'll pass through. And yes, it might be dark and stormy when the clouds are there, but the sun is always still behind those clouds, and those clouds will move on. It's just reminding yourself that this state that you're in right now isn't going to last forever. And if you can hold on to that, then it makes it easier to resist those temptations, those urges.
I'm Paul Scolfort, and this is Powerful. In this series, I come clean about my own sobriety and the journey it took for me to get here. In each episode, I will speak to a special guest about their addictions and how they achieve sobriety and how they maintain a happy lifestyle today. David is one of the UK's leading addiction psychiatrists and has contributed to international treatment guidelines, academic journals, as well as mainstream media outlets. Additionally, he serves as Academic Secretary of the Royal College of Psychiatrists Addiction Faculty. Upon founding the new app Curb, David saw the potential to harnessing emerging technology to enable a greater self-management of harmful habits and addictive behaviours. He is also quite a handsome doctor, so check him out on YouTube. So in some of these episodes, there will be discussions of alcohol misuse, drugs, sexual abuse, suicide, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. David, thank you for coming. This is Powerful.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I'm really interested about being a clinical psychologist, about your Curb app, which launched yesterday, which is amazing, all the work you've done behind it, and working in the mental and well-being space. But before that, I would love to know a bit about you, where you're from, where you grew up, and how was your childhood?
Fair enough. It's funny, it's normally me that's asking these kind of questions.
You're now in a hot seat.
Yeah. I'm David. I grew up in the northeast of Scotland in a small village. And I grew up with three older sisters, mum and dad, and I guess had always kind of knew that I wanted to be a doctor, go into medicine. And so I studied in Dundee in Scotland, and then amongst my medical degree, I took a year out, did a degree in neuroscience, then went back and finished my medical degree.
It's really unusual that someone knows early on what they wanted to do. Was someone in your family working as a doctor, or how did you know about that space?
So my older sister is a doctor. So I'd seen her go off to medical school, and I'd seen her textbooks lying around, and I always find it really interesting. My mum's actually a medical secretary, and she was a secretary for an old age psychiatrist. So my mum would tell me all sorts of interesting anecdotes and stories from work, and I guess that would kind of spark an interest, I guess.
Yeah, it would influence you, I guess, and if you had no idea about that space.
Yeah.
So did you have a happy childhood?
Yeah, I'm really lucky, actually. My mum and dad have been just really supportive, like, throughout my whole life, I guess, and always kind of encouraging me, being really kind of proud. It's funny. So now, like, I'm gay, and I suppose, like, there's a lot of people like me growing up gay would have, in the village that I grew up in, probably would have struggled at school with kind of bullying and stuff like that. But I actually do feel quite fortunate that there was people around me that always had my back. I was quite lucky at school. Like, I was always surrounded by kind of really strong, assertive, attractive girls that kind of had looked out for me, essentially. I feel pretty lucky. But then that's maybe also my kind of cognitive bias, the way that I look at my experiences as well. I choose to remember and kind of acknowledge and celebrate the positives. And there, of course, like anybody, there's times that are not so good, but I think, again, probably because of what I do for a living, I might acknowledge that there are times that weren't so good, but I try not to let that consume me. It might it's an experience, but it's not who I am. So even if there were rough times, I would probably try and kind of not dwell on it too much.
Yeah, which is a smart thing to do. You are probably one of the best looking doctors in town. Has that affected you anyway? And what I mean by that is, we were both models.
Yes. Yeah.
For the audience who don't know, and you can tell me about that. But it's odd that sometimes if you stand out because of the way you look, that can be just as bad as if you have something wrong with you, because people kind of try and pull you down or comment all the time. Did that affect you in any way?
Well, it's funny because we were both models. We were both with the same model agency, and I actually remember seeing you up in big posters in the agency in the studio there. But we were different kind. You were probably the face of Giorgio Armani, where I was the Giorgio's as the range catalog model. Did it ever affect me in a negative way? Probably. Do you know, actually, the weirdest experience I've had is people using pictures of me for catfishing. And there was a phase where, again, because I was on Instagram, people were taking those pictures off Instagram and using them for dating websites. And there was one person who was scamming women for money and using pictures of me to catfish.
Yeah.
So that was a bit weird.
I had that too.
Yeah.
And I was lucky, actually, because I think people over years have known that I'm a pretty good guy.
Yeah.
And I would never ask for money or anything like that or use those things. So I always get a message saying, your face is now on this site and your name is this.
Yeah. Do you know, actually, with that experience, one of my friends sent me a picture, a screenshot, and it was somebody on Tinder, but they were advertising themselves as like a 45-year-old or something.
Charming.
45-year-old. And I was like 37 at the time. I was like, hang on a minute. I don't know what I'm more offended by.
Phone that person up. We need to change that.
He's had it on 7 years.
When you were modeling, again, people always say to me, oh, it must have been like an incredible business. It's just you turn up, you get paid lots of money and you wear clothes. That's it.
Yeah.
Which is completely wrong.
Yeah.
How did you notice anything there about your own self-worth and how people treated you, how that affected you, whether it was negative or positive?
Yeah. So I was really lucky that I got scouted when I was maybe like 22 or 23. So I was already halfway through medical school. And so I was already a little bit older. I already kind of felt like I knew what I was doing. This was going to be just like a really great adventure for me. So I already had that kind of sense of self. But I do remember going to castings and being really intimidated and seeing all these guys that were like 6'2", 6'3", and feeling short. And I'm 6 foot, right? But it gave me a real kind of not a complex, but I remember thinking, fuck, I'm really short.
I was the second shortest person in my agency.
Yeah. But the thing is, you're not short. It's just when you compare yourselves to this kind of like slightly, this is not a normal cohort of people. This is a distorted kind of representation of what the world looks like.
Yeah.
And you start comparing yourself to this distorted kind of skewed version. And you think that you're short when you're 6 foot and you're not.
Completely, and that's what I mean. But people don't realize that I remember I've shared this before, that I did my first catwalk show in Milan for Catherine Hamlet, and the girl in front had like, she was 6 foot, anyone had 6-inch heels. The guy behind me was probably 6'3", and I had just flat shoes on, and someone literally looked up and was like, oh, he's short, isn't he? And just looked down, and that absolutely tortured me for about 2 years.
Do you know, it's funny actually, because I think this is a common issue when you're like a male model and you're like maybe 6'6", 6'1", but you're paired up with a girl for a shoot and she's 5'11". And she's wearing 4-inch heels. And so you're kind of like there and your tippy toes.
Stretching.
I can definitely relate to that. I had funny experiences as well where, you know, there's casting directors that are kind of rude in front of you and will talk about you as if you're like a piece of meat or as if you're not there, you know, saying, oh, his shoulders are too wide, or he's not going to fit the clothes, or like he's not lean enough or whatever. And that was always an issue for me as well. Like when you go to casting and then they say, okay, now take your shirt off. And you'd be like, well, I don't know if I want to.
Yeah.
And Yeah, but I was really lucky as well, though, because I had a friend who was almost like an older brother figure. He was really a successful model. And I remember him always saying to me, you know, David, you're really lucky because you've got another career. Like, you have, this isn't it for you. You've got something else.
Yeah.
And because I would sometimes say to Mark, I'd be like, because he would get booked for, like, you know, campaigns with Gillette or whoever. And I'd be like, oh, I wish I was getting booked for these kind of campaigns. And but Mark helped me to kind of shift my frame of reference in terms of my own, you know, validation of my self-worth. And because Mark would look at what I was doing, he was really envious, like, wow, well, you're at medical school, that's incredible, that's something that you should be proud of.
Yeah.
And so it was funny, actually. It was actually my friend Mark who was the one that helped give me that frame of reference to change how I maybe felt in those moments where, you know, I was not getting booked for anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it probably does for a lot of kind of models.
That's the reality. Is, again, if you're looking from the outside, it all looks shiny and great, and you always see photo shoots with flashing light bulbs and music, and it looks really exciting. Yeah. But 90% of the work you're doing is trying to get work.
Yeah.
And it can be really tough when you've just got these people that do look at you and they're like, I always had big shoulders. And some people are like, wow, you look really fit.
Yeah.
And a lot of people in Italy, though, was literally saying, oh, your back's too big, you're never going to fit the clothes, and make you feel really, really bad.
Yeah.
It's incredible, actually, how that can affect people.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've seen models get turned away from jobs. You know, you've arrived on set and then getting turned away. And I think it does take a lot of strength of character,
yeah,
not to feel rejected by that. You know,
good
that,
to have friends like Mark as well to actually, yeah, reframe something in a positive way.
Yeah, and he, you know, he's also Scottish, kind of no nonsense, yeah, and kind of a bit of a kind of fiery attitude. And you know, I think I probably adopted a bit of that kind of persona.
Yeah.
You know, if you face rejection, just be like, well, you know, screw them. Like, I'm going off to do something else instead.
Yeah.
And not let it consume you.
Well, yeah, exactly, because you can put all of your life on there because you are being identified by your looks, your shape and everything else, and it can be quite soul-destroying. So yeah. How long did you model for, and when did... And if you was at medical school already, did that mean you was just doing a few seasons and you went back?
Yeah, so I had two agencies. I had one in London, and then I also had one in Scotland. I actually got more work with the agency in Scotland, more kind of commercial-type work, and then with the agency in London... really didn't work very much with them at all, partly because I wasn't prepared to kind of come up and down for castings and, you know, yeah, for jobs that weren't actually really even that big money. So all in all, I think I did maybe 3 or 4 seasons. But I don't know, I actually loved it. I mean, I know, I think it can be a really toxic industry, but for me, it also opened doors. I got to meet really interesting people. I got to go to great parties.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was excitement as well. And for me, actually, as a junior doctor in a medical school, a lot of the time I was working really hard, doing really unglamorous stuff. And I know the industry is not as glamorous as people think it is. But at the time, you know, doing like a runway show or something, or meeting interesting people, it was
that is exciting, yeah, to do, yeah, that. I don't care what you say, but runway shows, yeah, are full of dopamine levels, people screaming, you're walking down, it's a good fun thing to do.
Yeah, yeah, I did enjoy that. And also kind of like camaraderie as well, meeting the other models. Once you've all been booked and you're kind of relaxed, you're like, oh good, we've all been booked, we've all got the job here. There was that kind of like sense of excitement and the build up and stuff, and I enjoyed it. It never paid well like that stuff, but it was fun.
You're incredibly qualified. So from starting in medical school, what was your drive to be so qualified? Was there a natural curiosity, or was there things in the past? It sounds like you had a great upbringing.
Yeah.
But were there things that drove you to really understand about mental health and well-being?
I think I was a big nerd. I thought I wanted to be a neurologist. So that's why I did the extra degree in neuroscience. But when I was doing that degree in neuroscience, what I realized that the really exciting, interesting things about your brain weren't about kind of movements. It was all about the way it made you think or feel. And then, yeah, I guess I'm naturally curious. And the other thing is I was really lucky. I had people take me in under their wing and take a chance on me, give me opportunities to kind of contribute to kind of international prescribing guidelines or do really innovative research. And then making those connections, those contacts, and working hard as well, because but I don't see it. When you enjoy your job, it doesn't feel like hard work. Yeah. It feels like playtime. If it's something that you really enjoy doing. And I was just really lucky that I found an industry and I found a profession that I just really enjoyed.
You have to have a good personality. You have to be likable no matter what industry you're in, for people to take you under their wing. Because, you know, I can just say, referencing to modeling or acting, that there's incredibly good looking guys out there that are in better shape than me. But you have to work with people. And at the bottom line, it comes down to personalities and people's business. So you must have a great personality, which I know you do, to get on. You know?
Yeah. I used to do Harvey Nichols every season. And I think it was just because the stylist kind of liked me. And that was probably got on well with me. But with my patients, I think a big part of it is maybe being likable, but also just being kind. And there's a lot of the time I think, okay, great. Like I know my stuff. I've written international prescribing guidelines. So I know the medications that I can use. And I know kind of different modalities of talking therapy that I can use. But a lot of the time it's just about being a nice person, being kind, being compassionate. And I do actually think a lot of the time that the patients that come to see me, it's maybe because I'm just nice to them as well.
Well, probably as well. I think if you're in a vulnerable position with anything in mental health, whether it's alcohol, drugs or other issues, it can be intimidating to go to an authority, be it a doctor or psychiatrist. I know that I met someone years ago that tended to talk at and down rather than with.
Yeah.
And that's quite a unique skill to talk with people and have that empathy.
Yeah, definitely. There's I used to teach medical students, or I still do teach medical students actually, in London. And actually active listening skills is one of the things I try and teach them. So in a clinical setting, what I would encourage them to, you know, ask an open question and then afterwards try and repeat back what the person said, you know, demonstrate that you've listened, check with them that you've understood what they've said. But what that does is it helps the person that you're sitting opposite, helps them to make them feel seen and heard. And actually for a lot of my patients, that's what they really value. They value being seen and heard. And a lot of the time they just really want to tell their story.
Yeah.
And again, so it's actually a lot of these soft skills that I think people value.
Soft skills are really powerful and they're really important because they're very human. And it's amazing how many people don't know how to listen or hear you. They can pretend they're listening, but they can't hear you because they're usually trying to, you know, gather the information or tell their part of the story or something at the same time.
Yeah.
And it never ceases to amaze me. I always look at people and I'm like, you just zoned out. You're not listening right now, are you?
The other thing, I'm not perfect, and I'm very bad for this, but the other thing I've noticed other people doing and I've noticed myself doing is just waiting their turn to talk. So in like a boardroom meeting, for example, you might kind of have people going around kind of talking away and you can kind of clock people they're just waiting their turn to talk.
Yeah.
And I do that myself, but I do that when I'm nervous and I'm anxious and I'm probably just rehearsing what I want to say.
Which is understandable. That's like being backstage with someone before they go on stage.
Yeah.
Actors look really crazy actually because you're just walking up, down, talking to yourself.
Yeah.
Remembering your lines wherever you are.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have any experience of the acting world, but I can imagine that's even more intense than modeling, just because, in fact, I've got friends who are actors and they've talked about kind of filming kind of like horror films or filming like really intense scenes and living through that trauma of those types of scenes. So I can't, it's interesting because we've talked a little bit about how being a model affects your mental health, but whenever I meet actors, I'm always really interested by thinking, wow, I wonder how acting affects your mental health.
It's such a good point.
Yeah.
And I think it does to a lot of people. I've walked away from there, and I didn't do loads of stuff. I wasn't a fantastic actor, but I trained for 3 years in Meisner and I trained 2 years in method acting. It was very interesting. There's a slight difference, but in Meisner technique, for example, if I was coming through the door to do a scene with you and it was, say, a very sad scene, you'd preload your mind with positive things that have just happened. For example, you might have gone, oh, I've just won the lottery, or I've just got the best job I've ever had. And you feel the feelings and get into that thing. So when you come through the door, you're, and then whatever you're, you could be saying, oh, the cat just died. Yeah. And so that it hits you really hard and you turn from one to the other. But what was really interesting about that was programming your mind and really getting to learn that if you give yourself a sentence or a scenario and you really picture it and you really feel it, you can completely change your state.
Yeah.
It was very interesting. And when I did methods, that I was nervous about.
Yeah.
Because you do bring up old experiences. We did a lot of like body sensing meditations and really going through old scenarios. And that, there was, I remember doing a scene in something and I thought, God, was that me thinking that? Or was that this character thinking that? And that wobbled me a little bit. I found that a little bit scary, to be honest, because I felt like you couldn't hold on to anything stable. So you've got to be, I think actors have to be incredibly well-balanced and grounded to play like that. Because, you know, some people are classically trained to just play it. But I think these Russian styles that have been adopted by Americans are a bit different.
Yeah. It's honestly, it's so interesting. It's super interesting.
At what point did you move into being interested about alcohol and drugs? People maybe have a drink or alcohol problem.
So I've had people close to me in my personal life, and that's probably as much as I probably want to say. But I've had people very close to me that have had issues with alcohol. So I've seen that up close. But also, I think I've always enjoyed kind of championing the underdog. And when I was training when I was a junior doctor, mental health it wasn't popular. It was still really quite stigmatized.
Yeah.
And actually I remember kind of consultants and people telling me like, why on earth are you wasting your degree being a psychiatrist? You know, and people actually even being a bit patronizing, saying, you know, if you wanted to, you could almost, you know, you could be a GP, you could be, you could work in general medicine in a hospital.
Yeah.
But actually for me, I loved mental health even before it was kind of, you know, in vogue, or before it was kind of receiving the attention it does now. And the reason why I loved it was because I always felt like that was an area that I could add loads of value. And very often it was people that were really vulnerable and they weren't getting treated with respect anywhere really. And so even within mental health, addiction is an area that's even more stigmatized because it's perceived that there's this choice or decision and people are to blame for their addictions. There's a lot less sympathy for conditions like, you know, alcohol dependence compared to, say, bipolar affective disorder.
Yeah.
And so when I was a junior doctor and I was, you know, even within psychiatry, and I was meeting people who were living with addiction and seeing that kind of suffering up close. And it's suffering. For some reason, I was drawn to it because, again, it just felt like there was this huge unmet need, and it made me feel useful. And actually even like, well, not being a nerd again, but the neurobiology of addiction is really interesting as well. So I find that kind of side of it interesting. And then again, being totally candid, it wasn't popular. So because mental health, because addiction wasn't a popular area, it meant I got really good opportunities. So again, like I mentioned, contribute to international prescribing guidelines, and I got really good jobs, and I found this kind of path. And I think if I'd gone into a more competitive field, like if I was trying to become an orthopedic surgeon in London, or a plastic surgeon or something like that, it would have been a lot more competitive. And I don't know if I'd have had those opportunities.
Yeah.
So, there's a whole bunch of different reasons why I went into addiction psychiatry.
Well, thanks for your honesty. It's really nice to hear. And it's beautiful that you have that compassion, because it's such a stigma still. Not so much if you're in the space, but there's still people that, you know, my dad's funny. He'd be like, well, if you don't drink, you're fine.
Yeah.
And you should stop doing this. And, you know, we've had some guests on here that have had unbelievable upbringings that you just wouldn't wish on anybody. And actually, you know, I can sit here and think, God, why would they bother getting sober? It must be such a painful experience. But they've all flourished and come through and are happy and great examples of that. What, for those listening that don't really know, what what is alcoholism?
Mm-hmm.
And then separately, what is addiction?
Yep.
And are they two different things? Because I read that, I think it was in 1954, that they qualified alcoholism in the States as a disease
mm-hmm.
and an illness. Don't know about addiction over there. Has that been qualified over here now? And when and how does that work?
So, yeah, so within psychiatry, we use two different diagnostic manuals. One is the DSM and then one is ICD-10 or ICD-11 now. So there's these two different diagnostic manuals and they're slightly different, but largely the criteria for giving somebody a diagnosis of alcohol dependency, there's these characteristics. So loss of control over the amount that you drink. And but by the way, this is also true for any harmful habit. So it's not just alcohol. Yeah. But so one of the criteria is loss of control. So once you start, you can't stop and you drink more than you would intend to drink. Cravings. So kind of having preoccupations, like preoccupying thoughts or even physical sensations, that urgency to kind of want the substance or the alcohol. There's continued use despite the knowledge of harm. And that harm can be emotional, physical, it can be your relationships, it can be your kind of occupation, your kind of social kind of harm. There's all sorts of ways that alcohol or other substances can be causing harm. But continuing to use the substance or drink with that knowledge is another indicator. Another criteria is withdrawal symptoms. So alcohol famously causes withdrawals, causes the shakes and tremors when you become dependent on it. You can even get seizures and hallucinations with a condition called delirium tremens. And then another criteria for addictive substances as well and for dependency is tolerance. So again, you might kind of be able to relate to this in that when you first start drinking, you might have one or two beers and you're really drunk.
Mm.
But when people have been drinking for a long time, over many, many years, the amount of the alcohol, the amount of that substance that they need to have the same effect increases. So instead of having two beers and getting drunk, you might be able to drink 10 or 20 beers and still not get drunk. Mm. And when I was growing up as a kind of teenager in Scotland, that was like a kind of a sign of strength, a sign of masculinity, like how many beers can you handle? And you would wear it with a badge of honor, the fact that you can handle your drink. What that actually means at a kind of physiological level is that your GABA receptors have become desensitized to alcohol. They've been exposed to so much of this substance that it's numbed them and they're no longer responding. So in order for you to get the same effect, you need to consume more of that substance. And that same of, say, alcohol, cocaine, opiates, even kind of actually behavioral addictions as well have that kind of same kind of diagnostic criteria.
Is that because are the receptors in the brain the same for alcohol as they are for, say, cocaine?
Different receptors, different neurotransmitters. GABA receptor for alcohol makes you feel, it's an inhibitory. It's a receptor that sits on inhibitory pathways. And so it can make you feel relaxed and it can, in the short term, relieve anxiety.
Hmm.
But then when the alcohol unbinds from the GABA receptor, you get this rebound excitation. And so that you get that rebound anxiety. So again, a lot of people will relate to that kind of Sunday night blues or dread,
yeah.
Kind of, or hangover anxiety, or the beer fear. But you also get with the inhibitory effect of alcohol and the GABA receptors, it also inhibits your frontal lobe. And your frontal lobe is really, really important for executive function, like planning, decision-making. And so that's why people tend to do some slightly silly things when they're drunk, make bad decisions.
Yeah.
But the other thing that your frontal lobe does is it regulates your emotions. It regulates the limbic system. So you get emotional dysregulation. So you might be more likely to laugh or to smile or make jokes and have heightened positive experiences, but you can also get heightened negative experiences because of this downregulation of your frontal lobe and the reduction of the regulation of your limbic system. I've rambled on about the neuroscience and but it's
so important because people don't understand.
Yeah.
And there's still this whole thing, you know, about I think how much you can drink, your legend or what you do, which is crazy.
Mm.
And I think what was really important, what you said, is that why I went back to keep doing, say, drinking different things, because I had a desire to belong, but also was this false sense of having fun and it's crazy. And, you know, I guess all the chemicals in your body, which I remembered, would bring me back to that, because daily life felt pretty glum without it. And that got deeper and a bigger feeling as life went on.
Yeah.
So without substances and alcohol, I was very negative. And I found getting up just boring, and I lost all that life and that figure that I liked, and going to the gym, which I love, stopped going to the gym, didn't like to do stuff. Is that because that you've basically changed the chemicals in your brain over a long period of time?
So when you expose your brain to a substance like alcohol or cocaine, it changes the way that your brain works in a couple of different ways. So there's a concept called synaptic plasticity. So the connections in your brain, they're not fixed like that forever. They're plastic. That means, you know, those connections can change. And exposure to substances long term, it changes the way the receptors behave, but also the different connections. But also, sometimes I think you can train your brain like your biceps. You know, if you think a certain way for a duration of time, it almost trains you into those patterns. And so if you get into habit of thinking that the only way that I can have fun is with alcohol or with substances, then to have fun without them is going to feel really jarring and odd and uncomfortable. And so often when people are kind of changing their relationship with alcohol or substances or quitting, it's really difficult because they have to retrain their brains to think and feel different ways. And actually what I get my patients to do is adopt a really curious mindset and be experimental and experiment with different ways of having that underlying need met. So whatever alcohol was doing for you, if it was helping you to relax, if it was helping you to kind of be disinhibited and have fun, if it was helping you to fall asleep at night, have a curious mindset. Try and see if you can experiment with other ways to meet that underlying need. And it's difficult. It is hard at first, but it gets easier. And I try and ask people to see it as a challenge and see it as something it's an opportunity to try new things.
Which is a great way of doing it, because you look forward to something. And a curious mind is a great way of putting it, because it is, you know, when I became sober, what I did realize, by the way, is that the group that I got sober with, we laughed at our own adversity and our terrible stories. Yeah. And if anyone was listening, they'd think it was crazy. But it was the first time I think I belly laughed in many years. So whatever laugh I was doing, not that it was false, but it wasn't real in the sense that I felt it and I looked. It was more of a drunken laugh and, you know, what felt real and was exciting. But I remember belly laughing for the first time without anything and thinking, wow, I feel alive. It's a really nice thing.
And the thing is, well, it's real fun as well, because I always say that if you need alcohol to make an activity fun, then it's not fun. Or if it's not fun without alcohol, it's not fun.
Yeah.
So it sounds like what you had there was you were kind of enjoying real, authentic fun. And I've never really been into drugs. And part of the reason I was never into drugs, because I would see people using kind of cocaine or cannabis or weed, and they'd be giggling or laughing. And I remember just thinking, that's not real though. I'm sober, or I'm a bit tipsy, but I know that wasn't that funny. And I didn't, so that's what I didn't like that about substances like cannabis or cocaine, because I felt like it wasn't real fun. But I mean, I'm a total hypocrite, because I do enjoy drinking. I still drink. And so I'm a total hypocrite in that when I'm drunk or tipsy or whatever, it's equally not as authentic as that kind of joy that you talked about there when you're sober.
I think when you cross the line, people ask me about, I'm not the sort of person that used to smoke and then starts coughing and waving, walking down the street like, you're polluting my oxygen, go away. I think if people can drink safely, I know no alcohol is good for you. Yeah. I understand that. And we are quite skewed in this country compared to, like, my wife's from Italy. And when you go there, the teenager's going out having a gelato late at night or having a coffee or something, and there's just no alcohol involved. So it's definitely something in this country, Ireland, Scotland, and other parts.
Well, I mean, when I was growing up as a teenager, oh my gosh, we definitely drank really heavily and it was binge drinking. And there was definitely this culture of the more that you drank, the kind of tougher you were seen and the more masculine. And it was like almost like this badge of honor of how much you could drink. But actually we know now from epidemiological studies and the research that the younger you are when you start drinking, the more likely you are to become a heavy drinker or a dependent alcohol-dependent drinker later in life.
And it's funny because what that gave you in initially when you're younger, and it's a heroic thing to do or perceived to be a heroic thing to do, is takes it all away from you. Mm. And it's quite sad when you see a guy, say my age in his 50s, just drinking and drinking, and you can see that it's really took a toll. It's quite sad. What's the difference between a heavy drinker and someone that's dependent? I know we don't use the word alcoholic much. I don't mind because I am one. But what is that fine line that's crossed? Can you pin that down chemically, or is it a psychological thing, or is it a combination of both?
So what's the difference between alcohol dependence, harmful drinking, kind of social drinking? There's criteria for alcohol dependency, and that's the kind of the loss of control, cravings, the continued use despite knowledge of harm, the tolerance, withdrawal effects. Harmful drinking, there's government guidelines in terms of what is considered harmful drinking. Although, again, you picked up on this earlier, actually, there is no safe amount of alcohol. Alcohol is a class one carcinogen. It's in the same classification as asbestos and radiation. So there's no amount of alcohol that does not damage your health. The Lancet, a big medical journal, published an article about this not that long ago, and it made headlines. People might have heard that article. So there's no amount of alcohol that is safe for our health. Harmful use of alcohol, God, I should really know this, but it's anything about over above 12 units per week. Mm. Which is not an awful lot. That's about maybe four or five beers per
some
week.
People will be laughing at those stats thinking, yeah, I have that in an afternoon,
yeah,
and I'm still here. That's the problem, I think, when people, it's hard to take on board that you can say that no alcohol in any form really is safe, it's harmful, yeah, because it's been in our culture for so long.
Yeah.
And I think because it does instant damage if you have a car crash or you fall over and bang your head hard. There's lots of things that can happen. But I think as human beings, it will never happen to me.
Yeah.
It always happens to someone else. Maybe it's like on a packet of cigarette when you see the terrible picture of teeth and lungs.
Yeah.
You just turn the packet over. It's too much to understand. I don't know how it could be reframed for people to really understand what the damage is.
Yeah. It's interesting you're talking about those packets of cigarettes and the with the horrible pictures on them. And often I do wonder, in fact, I was at the Royal College of Psychiatry, so I'm the academic secretary for the addiction faculty there, and we were talking about the success of the public health campaign to stop people from smoking. And we were saying, God, how have they managed to be so successful with kind of stopping people from smoking? Why haven't we been able to do that with alcohol? And I am a bit of a cynic sometimes, because the alcohol industry is worth billions and billions.
It's so powerful.
Yeah.
And it's so powerful, and there's so many lobbyists to lobby it as well.
Indeed. And sometimes I do think we've kind of been brainwashed into thinking that drinking alcohol will make you sexy, it'll make you attractive, people, you'll be more popular, you'll have more friends. If you look at the way that alcohol is advertised to us, so, you know, it's on the shirts of rugby players, Guinness, or, you know, football players. And
it used to be racing drivers.
Yeah. And it's glamorized.
Yeah.
And it's anything but glamorous, really. It's the way that it's been portrayed and advertised and fed to us. It's completely distorted.
It's very clever psychology and marketing, because the reality is that as people, generally, a lot of people are self-conscious, they have inhibitions and stuff. And when you see someone who doesn't have it, it's attractive, because you're like, how'd you do that?
Yeah.
We have the golden answer in this glass or bottle or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a fast fix to that. But I think in someone who's in recovery, I asked my questions, the questions that you actually stated earlier, which were very clever. You know, first things I asked, well, how am I, if I ever get married or if I have a birthday or what do I do with a celebration? And I had to sit there and really break down to myself that I thought I was shy, but I was self-conscious. Mm. Slight difference. Worrying about what people thought, maybe low self-esteem. But I knew I could have a conversation because clearly before I started drinking, I'd been talking for a long time. So yeah. I know I could mechanically do it. And then I did an acting course for 3 years, pretty much when I come out of the treatment center, because I wanted to do a positive activity. Mm. But within that, it was really, it was actually really amazing because it was aligned with recovery, but it helped me to talk, go through the emotions, play with stuff and realize yeah. actually all the things I was probably self-conscious and worried about, I could do freely. And that was like a little ecosystem for the big world when I went out into the big world. And I think that was, not that I tell everyone to go and do acting courses, but it's actually a very good thing to do.
I've actually had patients of mine who have been considering, should I pay X amount of money for talking therapy? And then actually they've changed their mind and I've had two patients do acting courses instead. And one of the things that they told me that they benefited from that was assertiveness.
Yeah.
So, and they developed drink refusal skills. And they rehearsed how to say no to drinks and how to turn down those drinks. And so it meant when they were in social settings, they had rehearsed and had this persona that they could adopt with kind of an answer.
It's really interesting because that's one of the things is peer pressure. And I always talk about it. You don't want to be the odd one out. You don't want to say no when everyone's like, hey, you know, this is really good or this, whatever it is. But doing that, standing in your own ground and really saying no when you mean it is no one can go against that.
Yeah.
No, I'm not drinking tonight. Oh, you sure? Yeah, 100%. Thank you very much. Move on. You don't have to be rude about it. But when you stand in yourself and that energy, people don't kind of tend to push. But when you're a little bit like, oh, you know, I shouldn't really, but oh, you know, and then you just get pushed into it. So there is something about being assertive and it's great to hear people have got that through acting courses.
I sometimes teach people about different personas they can adopt with those drink refusal skills. So you can be the joker, you can diffuse a situation with a kind of a silly joke about alcohol or kind of, I've only got two brain cells left and if I have that beer, that's going to kill them both off, you know, or being a table turner and turning the conversation round to the other person, you know. Or being, the little white liar, so saying, like, I can't drink tonight because I'm on antibiotics. But the ultimate is just to say no. And I will tell my patients that they don't owe anybody else. They don't owe anybody any further explanation. You can just say no. And that's good enough. That's an answer.
Yeah. And actually, it's more powerful. I've tried all of the others.
Yeah.
And many more. And it's really knowing yourself that you don't want it.
Mm-hmm.
Can't be pushed.
Yeah.
Do you still work in the NHS as well as at the Priory?
No, I was in the NHS for about 12 years and I really, really loved it. But then I kind of knew that there was other things I wanted to do and I couldn't fulfill those other ambitions while still working full time in the NHS. And so I was really lucky that there was an opportunity came up at the Priory Hospital in Roehampton and that allowed me to work there one day a week where I still have a small clinical practice. I see patients with problems with like addiction, other mental health issues, ADHD is another kind of, and there's a lot of overlap with ADHD and mental health and ADHD and addiction as well. Huge, huge overlap. But that then also gave me the freedom to have almost like this portfolio career and co-found Curb. The app that we've been building for about 3 years now.
Which I'm really interested to move on to, actually. So I'm so sorry, we were supposed to go to launch last night. I couldn't go. I did have FOMO and I felt really bad. I hate turning things down at the last minute, but I seriously couldn't leave my house. But 3 years in the making. Well done, congratulations.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what is Curb? How does it work? And how did you bring technology infused with mental health and well-being?
So Curb is a mobile app for your phone and it helps people to change their relationship with alcohol. And we offer three different programs. There's one to reduce drinking, there's one to quit drinking, And then there's a program for recovery. So for people who are kind of long-term sober and they're just looking to kind of enjoy celebrating kind of a sober lifestyle, we do an initial assessment with you to understand your habit neurotype. So understanding what triggers you to drink.
Is it a questionnaire on the app?
There's kind of, as part of the onboarding process, we try and learn as much as we can about you, and we use machine learning to then adapt the types of interventions that we would offer you. So it's a much more personalized experience. It's not like a one size fits all. It's the program that you receive is it's in accordance with your personal goals, whether that's reducing, quitting, or kind of staying sober.
There's kind of three lanes that you can sit in with that.
That's right, yeah. And then every day you make a pledge for whatever your goal is. And we follow up with you the next day to check in to see if you've kept your pledge. So there's that degree of accountability.
Which is really important.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, without accountability, then why are you going to stick to your goals? You need that kind of reminder. Yeah. And then we also offer daily lessons. So if you think about Duolingo, but if it was lessons to help you to train your brain to think differently. So we've built these lessons inspired by cognitive behavioral therapy. So looking at things like permissive thoughts and training your brain to think differently about alcohol.
Is that all in the three lanes, David? Or
so each of those three programs will have those lessons, those exercises. The other thing that we offer for everybody in the platform as well is we offer these tools to help people to manage those urges in the moment. What I recognize with my patients is that they would see me like maybe once a week or once a month, but in between times, that was when they were encountering all of those different triggers and those urges to drink. And so I wanted to build something that they would have in their pocket so that no matter where they were, and when they had that urge or that temptation to drink, that they would have the tools that they would need in their pocket. And so the other thing that we do that's, I think, quite clever is when you tell us that you're having an urge, over time, we learn where, when, why you're experiencing that urge. Mm. So the resource, the tools that we offer you become more and more appropriate for that particular moment in time. And so we've spent 3 years now doing innovative research and development with prototypes, with studies that we published in the British Journal of Psychiatry Open, presenting at international conferences, presenting at the Royal College of Psychiatry, the Addiction Conference. We won first prize earlier this year when we presented a study about the predictive biomarkers for craving alcohol and alcohol consumption.
Can I just ask you, what is the difference between a craving and obsession? Because I understand that a craving itself only lasts for a short period of time, but the obsessive thought about I need something, whether it's to take away the feelings or just to change the way I feel, is completely different from actually having a craving. And a craving is supposed to be once you start, then you can't stop.
Mm.
What's your view on that?
I think an obsessional thought is something which could be a component of a craving. Sometimes when patients talk to me about cravings, it's a thought, but it's also an emotion and it's a physical sensation. So my view would be, I suppose, that an obsessional thought is a component of that whole experience of a craving.
Yeah.
And people use different words for it as well. So it's interesting, when we were building this app, we wanted the users to be at the heart of this app. So we did loads and loads of user interviews and kind of questionnaires and surveys. And so a lot of people didn't relate to the word craving, and they would maybe relate to the word urge.
Interesting.
Just the urge to drink, because the other thing is that words like cravings mean different things for different people. So for some people, you know, they might relate to the word craving with, say, sugar, but it might be what they experience is doesn't have the intensity quite of a craving. Or it happens so quickly, like just an urge. They might be kind of walking down the aisle in the supermarket and it's not because of a craving, but something's triggered that urge.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it's true. It's true, because then you get into specific words in English and what that means to different characters.
You picked up something that was really important, though, the fact that cravings don't last forever. And that's a really, really important point that we talk about that on the app Curb, that this urge that you're experiencing it'll probably last for 10 or 15 minutes. And with urges, we describe them a bit like a wave, because that intensity of feeling will grow and it'll get bigger and it'll get stronger. But you have to remember that it will also fall,
yeah,
a bit like a wave. And so what we encourage people to do is to imagine it's a wave, that feeling, but also imagine that you're a surfer and you're going to surf the urge. And so this discomfort is temporary.
Yeah.
If you can just hold on and surf that urge, and it will pass. The other analogy that we sometimes use as well as the wave analogy, is imagining it's like a cloud in the sky. So any of our emotions or feelings, whether they're kind of unpleasant ones or urges, they're temporary, a bit like the clouds in the sky are temporary, and they'll pass through. And yes, it might be dark and stormy when the clouds are there, but the sun is always still behind those clouds, and yeah, those clouds will move on. It's just reminding yourself that this state that you're in right now isn't going to last forever. And if you can hold on to that, then it makes it easier to resist those temptations, those urges.
It makes it incredibly easy. I wish your app was out when I started to get sober, because I had to learn this all myself. And there wasn't much to Google and look at and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I kind of did self-experiment. So I knew my ultimate goal was that I didn't want to drink. I rinsed that part of my life and it didn't serve me anymore.
Mm.
And I would get these urges where I would just sit there as we're sitting, and the next minute I'm standing up and I'm walking to the fridge as if there's something in there.
Yeah.
And I'd really practice mindful meditation, and I'd catch myself in the middle of this urge thinking, what? I was just reading a book or watching TV. Why has my body jumped up and going to the fridge?
Yeah.
A, there's no alcohol in there. So consciously I know that, but subconsciously maybe I don't.
Mm.
So I would stop and have to really think about what just happened. Mm. And it was when I felt lonely or uncomfortable or vulnerable, or I was having a thought of, how did I get here? What's happened to my life? How am I going to move forward? So any of those negativities that come in, I really noticed that would drive me to want to change the way I feel.
Yeah.
And it took me quite a long time to learn with that and sit with it. And it does feel like a wave. Yeah. There is definitely a higher peak. And when you come down, and the relief after not taking that urge is immense. And in that relief comes self-esteem.
Yeah.
A bit of security, a bit of faith that actually if I don't yield to that, I have a chance of. And in my experience, those urges it was almost like a test. They were pretty significant in the beginning, but then they'd get longer and longer and longer and longer and dissipate and dissipate. So I think that's fantastic what you're doing.
You're speaking my language, and there's so much of what you were saying there I could totally relate to with my patients, but also with me personally, actually, it's interesting. You talked about sitting with it and sitting with those feelings. And actually, a lot of people who use alcohol to manage those feelings, they've never sat with those feelings before. Yeah. So again, it's quite frightening. It's difficult to do it first, but it does get easier. The other thing that you talked about was that relief once the urge has gone. And actually, because I'm constantly trying to reduce the amount of alcohol I drink, because alcohol is not good for me, and I would like to drink less. And actually, I would say I'm sober, sober curious. And at some point, I might completely stop drinking. But every time I resist the urge to have a drink, once that urge is gone, it's not just a sense of relief for me. It's also a bit of a sense of a victory. And I feel a bit smug with myself. And the next day, if I've been tempted, like I've been at the cinema or something, and I've not had a beer, the next morning, I think, do you know what? I passed over in that beer, or somebody offered me a glass of wine at the table and I said no. The next day, I actually feel like, oh, David, well done.
It's true. And you can feel complete the benefits. There's something about discipline.
Mm.
And what happened was that for me, before I became sober, I did a 2-week loop where I wouldn't drink and use, but it would be white knuckling and hanging on.
Yeah.
I think if you make a fundamental decision, not a hope or a possibility, if you make an actual decision, which is cemented in a belief that I'm done now,
Yeah.
And then you have a focus, and then you understand what's really incredible is what's in your app. When you understand that, when you have tools at hand in your pocket and you can go, God, today I don't know what I'm doing, but let me just check in. I think it's really, I think it's a brilliant thing what you're doing, actually.
Yeah. Well, I think it's brilliant what you're doing, because, you know, you are an incredible model. You're like, you were like one of the, what was it? They called you the male supermodel.
Yeah.
But now you're a role model. And I think you sharing your story is so powerful, because I think a lot of people will draw kind of confidence and inspiration from hearing your story, and the fact that it gets easier as well, and it's life is better. But you talked about white knuckling it, but actually helping other people who might be watching podcasts like this to realize that, yeah, it's really difficult just now, and you are white knuckling it right now. But right now, you make it look like it's easy, or it sounds easy. And it's funny, because again, as a model, right, you've probably been used to sell all sorts of different things, clothes or cars or whatever. But now you're selling something which is actually really good for people. So yeah, I think what you're doing is really cool.
Thank you, David. I really appreciate that. Last question.
Yeah.
So anyone can download the app?
Yeah.
Is it free? Do you have to pay?
We're giving it away for free at the moment, because what we want to do is we want to build, improve it constantly. And so one of the things, the other thing as well, the reason why I made this app and this company was because I wanted to make sure that we had world-class support that was available for as accessible as possible for as many people. And so that, I guess we were making kind of world-class kind of research-led support as accessible as possible. So initially it's free, and at some point we're going to put a paywall in, because the company will have to.
A business has to work.
We have to pay for all the technology. Yeah. So at some point we are going to be putting in a paywall, but I'm really committed to making sure that this is as accessible as possible, because I want as many people to benefit from it as possible. This is like my baby. If I wanted to be rich, I would be on Harley Street, and I could be on Harley Street, or I'd be kind of filling my clinics up. But actually, this is like a real, real passion project for me. And actually, we've got a partnership in place with a national addiction charity called ADVAM, where we're giving them a proportion of the revenue as well. So when we do start charging a proportion of all of our revenue, not our profits, our revenue will be going to ADVAM, just because, again, it's a really great charity. They do incredible work. Because alcohol and addiction doesn't just affect that one person, it affects everybody around them. So again, that's why it was something that really important to me, that to build this company, but also to give something back to the people that they need the help as well.
Thank you very much, David.
Thank you.
Appreciate for having that. Me. I could talk to you for ages.
I know.
Maybe we'll do another bit, but yeah, that was really good.
Thanks, oh, okay. David. Good. No, I really enjoyed it as well. Like, I knew that it'd be a good podcast, because
this podcast is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also make a donation. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. And if you enjoyed This Is Powerful, please rate, review, and follow the podcast to share it with your friends, your family, anyone you can, and head over to social media. I always love to see and hear how you react to the episodes, and it's so helpful for our content to be shared. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica and Marty, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Henry, you know who you are, and to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. And there's a whole catalogue of episodes wherever you get your podcasts. But did you know you can also watch it on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with Paul Scholfer.